Or just reset it for one.
So we have a brand new feature that we're implementing today, very last minute as usual.
Go ahead, hit play.
We have this wonderful light bar that will actually let you know when how much time the presenters have left. As you see, it's counting off. So instead of giving a verbal 30-second warning, when you see it go orange up here, right when that orange hits the top, the presenter has 30 seconds, and it's your job to say, right about now.
30 seconds.
Okay, let's practice that one more time.
Okay. Just for a second.
Yeah.
Huh? Oh, actually, that's not a bad idea. Let's move over a little bit. So the guys in the front row will be responsible for saying... And then the guys in the front row can see that it, as it slowly approaches, we get the red here, so you guys in the front row have to pay a lot more attention. When it hits right about here, you're supposed to go... All right, well, we're already running behind schedule, so aesthetics and Mike, want to get up? So a couple just a little announcements, things that I'd like to get going. One, I forgot to plug in the clicker before I got here. Hopefully I'll find it. But if you would, for a moment, one thing that we need people to help out with is keywords and descriptions of each of the talks as they're going on. The video crew, when they release the videos, are going to want to be able to say what's happening at what time codes. So if you have a laptop and you're able, please go to 30c3.shownote.es. That'll take you to a pad where you'll be able to collaborate with many other people in the room and describing what's happening during each of the lightning talks, so that if people are looking for specific things or specific topics inside the talks and the recordings later on, they'll be able to find them very quickly if you can assist with that.
I was promised a clicker and Nick Farr in a hoodie.
You will get one of those two things, and I'll let you know which in a moment.
By the way, for those who are unaware, the title of our talk is Why Nick Farr Hates Presenters.
Oh, no, I've got it. Thank you. Yes, thanks. All right.
I wonder if that has radiation.
So please refrain from clicking during this presentation. The next thing is something, it's a community source project at the 20C3. John Perry Barlow of the EFF issued a declaration. And people here decided that maybe it's time that we, in light of everything that's happened here, and like that it's 10 years later, that we should update that declaration. We're running a lot of time, so I'm not going to be able to tell you much more than that, but please check out this link and share it among your friends. Check out the pad, check out the declaration 20 years ago, and let's see if we can't get the declaration updated and possibly presented during the closing ceremonies. And then I'm just going to breeze through this one really quickly for the people watching at
home.
What
does it even say? Oh, that was German. I thought that was just Nick slang. know if I want to see all of them, Nick. Wish I had a red card. What? Easiest lightning talk I've ever given.
Are you guys ready?
Sure. Yeah, but go to the beginning. There we go.
But yeah, there you go. Okay, go.
All right, so Hope. How many people have heard of Hope? Many of you. How many people have been to Hope? Some more would be better. That's what this talk is about. Also, this thing. Oh, there we go. There's a flyer. You might have seen it. This is the original that we sent to the printer. There's no spelling errors. The one you have in your hands, maybe. We can't guarantee that. So what is Hope anyway? Hope is a biennial hacker conference in the United States. It is possibly the largest of its kind in that continent. And it's been going around for 20 years. The first was in 1994.
Can you click over? Okay, yeah, and as you can see, there's a lot of cool things that go on. This is from the vending area at Hope, and we have all kinds of different types of places that come to contribute. Also, we've had a large variety of speakers. This is William Binney, the NSA whistleblower, and I think this was actually the first full-length public talk he ever gave, was at the most recent Hope conference. And we have all kinds of cool things like soldering and Segways. You guys ever ridden a Segway? They're cool. They also hurt when you fall. So
2014 is not a year we're in quite yet, but we will be soon. And July 18 to 20th of this coming year in New York City will be HopeX. We hope you'll join us. It'll be at the Hotel Pennsylvania, where almost all of them have been. We will have stuff about technology, about security, about hardware, software, crafting, art. We have had a chiptunes concert, really top-notch artists for the past few goes, hacking really in all of its senses. And what really excites us is when there's stuff that we haven't thought of before that people come and bring to the conference, so that we hope that you folks will not only attend but submit talks and workshops. We'll have our call for participation open soon. So a variety of stuff, really exciting. There is a caveat that we know about. It's in the United States, and that's a scary place for a lot of people. If you are, we're sorry.
It's not our fault.
We are collecting stories of things that happen to people at the border, borderstories@hope.net. If something particularly exciting or particularly dull has happened to you, send us an email. The one thing that we want to say about this is that, like, there's some jerks that you'll have to talk to when you land at the airport. But then after you're done with them, everyone that you interact with at the conference and in the city in general will be friendly and smiling or frowning. But you know. Nick Farr, I don't think I've seen him smile, but.
or wear a hoodie.
But maybe he took this picture. So there's the flyer again.
So yeah, if you want to find out more, go to x.hope.net. It's worth noting that we have another round of pre-registration starting on January 6th. And also, this for the first time, Hope will be accepting Bitcoin for registration. And I actually checked. There are two other conferences in America that accept Bitcoin, except both of them are Bitcoin conferences. So Hope is going to be the first non-Bitcoin conference accepting Bitcoin.
We also take real money, if that's what you prefer. So thanks, we'll see you there.
Yes.
All right, Serene, are you ready? Yeah, the clicker thing should be on the podium. And then when she goes, hit play. Okay. Oh, and don't forget two things to keep in mind. When you approach the podium, be sure to stay somewhat close to the microphone, because the further away you get, the harder it is for the people in the audience to hear, and it's also really annoying for the people watching the streams because they hear nothing. So you can adjust the microphone on the podium. Also, what appears on the screen is down here, so when you're giving your presentation, you don't have to look behind you to see what's going on, because that also makes it very, very difficult for the people watching the streams to understand you. So those are two quick reminders. Thank you for letting me say this, Serene. And whenever you're ready, 5 minutes is yours.
Hello, my name is Serene Han. I currently hack on stuff at Google Ideas, which is a think/do tank focusing on technologies that help people confront threats in the face of conflict, instability, or repression. Today, let's have a little chat about censorship and proxies. I suspect many of you are intimately familiar with this topic, so we probably don't need to reiterate all the ways and whys and hows in which censorship is fundamentally incompatible with human agency and our future. But one more little reminder probably won't hurt. Suppose you're trying to access the internet from within the borders of a repressive regime which engages in censorship. Indeed, the challenges of censorship abound in a variety of forms and severities, from want of music videos to the brutal cutdown of North Korean family trees. Censorship is a highly toxic meme which can and will be solved. In fact, we already have plenty of tools and approaches for countering repressive censorship, typically in the form of proxies and VPNs. But everybody has a different background, use case, and risk level, which makes circumvention messy and nuanced. Localized usability is just as, if not more, important than the security of these tools. Let's keep in mind that as we talk about proxies. Proxies today tend to be a cat and mouse game, since a proxy which is easy to find is easy to block. Beyond that, there are two big problems with proxies: trust and scalability. Trust is often lacking because neither the proxier nor the proxy provider typically know each other. This is certainly an issue since your proxy provider has a lot of power. For instance, they can block and misdirect your traffic, or perhaps they're actually state-sponsored and will throttle you when the Iranian elections roll around and you won't even know who the candidates are. The other problem is scalability, because it takes time and effort to set up a proxy service, and not everyone has the expertise and resources to run nice servers. Also, the more users you have, the more likely you will be blocked. But these problems are solvable. We don't actually need to put up with questionable or hard-to-use proxies. Let's make a stand. So, there's this project currently called uProxy, which I've been trading sleep on. It's a ubiquitous peer-to-peer proxy based on people trusting and helping each other. It's under development and will be open sourced as soon as possible. With your help, I think it will grow into an actually useful tool. How does it work? Let's say your friend Alice, unlike you, is staying in some hypothetical land where freedoms aren't trampled upon. With the uProxy browser extension, mirror clicks allow you and Alice to authenticate and proxy through each other. The trust scenario is more agreeable here because the idea is to leverage existing chat contacts. XMPP is typically available. Usually, regimes block XMPP only as a last resort because doing so would cause collateral damage to the state. But any communications route will do, after which uProxy will help you verify key hashes over video or audio, ZRTP style, and establish a DTLS over SCTP channel. And then maybe you can access greater swaths of internet without getting punked. Scalability is better here too. Instead of centralized, possibly shady, and unreliable servers, we have decentralized, harder to block intimate connections with people you could very likely get drunk with. There's not much time to go into further detail, but Let me clarify a couple things. Uproxy most certainly does not have all the answers. Uproxy does not guarantee anonymity like Tor, nor does it provide for file sharing. It's just a one-hop access to Alice's connection.
1 minute.
After which, it's her show. For what it's worth, Uproxy can't be shut down by Google because it's just a browser extension, and it will be open sourced. There's a lot of work to do, such as UX and obfuscation, and there will be many rounds of internal and external security review, as well as UX studies and testing. If you're interested in Uproxy, check up on uproxy.org for more information, or find me later here at Congress or on the internets. I'd really like to hear your thoughts and gripes. Thanks for listening.
Hello.
Okay. Yep, whenever you're ready.
Okay. I will talk a little bit about the CCTV mapping project. The idea is not new, but there are many similar local projects to mapping CCTV cams at and we try to collect the people. I tell you about the map. The concept is to build the map based on OpenStreetMap data. The idea is to mapping the surveillance in our daily life, shop cams, CCTV cams, and other cams. The people can say the poise, send the poise, in a formula and later in a with an Android app. We try to make it very simple. There's a alpha map now online with some parts of Berlin. I tell it. It's the first version. You see some poise, the cameras. We have also from the public train companies to cams included. There's another project, realmap.org. They collect for handicapped people poise, and that's a little bit the idea from the interface how it can be works. Also, the idea is to make it very easy for the user. Take a picture from a cam you see on the street. The geo check is included. Then send it to the server, and you have a new POI on OpenStreetMap. What we need: people like the idea, help us by the map, and more important is people who are better in Android developing. Thanks. You can find me in NX Village or send me a mail. Thanks.
Okay, I'm Johannes Meinusch. I earn my money as a manager in a company, IT manager. So I usually don't have a lot of time to hack things. And I always enjoy going to the conference here because I think it's one of the most inspiring conferences. So I will tell you what I did last year. And I bought at the last conference a Raspberry Pi. How do I click it, Nick? Ah, okay. Why? Why do I do things like that? I like to know, I like to learn, and I like my autonomy as far as possible, and I like a better world. So these are motivations for me to look into building smart meters with Raspberry Pis, for example. That's the pet project. Can you click? So it started with me by wondering how much energy does my house consume right now. And if you go down to the cellar, you can see this spinning wheel down there in your meter. But you never know how much energy you actually consume right now. You know what you use in a year, and so please click to the next one. So I know I have an average household, and it's actually something like 4,000 kilowatts per year, a lot, kilowatt hours per year, a lot for one man and half a girl. I asked that. So next. How do you measure that, your actually current consumption? Well, it's quite easy. You have a calibrated device down in your cellar, and you probably all know this flying wheel and the red mark, and 75 turns of that wheel is 1 kilowatt hour. So it's a nicely calibrated device. I didn't need to calibrate it. And then I need to interact with it. So how do you do that? I shine a light on it, Rolling Stones title, shine a light, an infrared light. Then you read the reflection with a phototransistor, use a Schmidt trigger, use the Raspberry Pi as hardware device, and use some Node.js and WebSockets, and you have a full stack project. Next. That's the hardware you need. You need a Schmidt trigger. Basically, this is like €5 hardware. You can solder that together and put it on the GPIO of the Raspberry Pi. I think that's one of the biggest things on the Raspberry Pi is actually that PIO. Next. And then you put it all in your cellar. Okay, I needed to learn a bit JavaScript programming and Node.js. That's on the top box. That's a Raspberry Pi connected. The blue light is connection to my wireless LAN. Next. The newer building block I made looks like this. This is an 8-knob Duplo Lego piece. Because it's quite hard to actually center the light shining and the phototransistor. So it seems to be easier with that. My daughter doesn't like that I use up her Lego blocks for that, but anyway, next. And then there's some source code involved. If anybody is interested, that's really ugly JavaScript. I like to become better, so you can check it out and send me comments, but please not too many, because I still have to get acquainted with GitHub. Next. And that's the measurement. And it's quite interesting what you see, what you learn from that. It's a log scale, and you see the past some 6 hours of some day in April in my house. And the first peak, the first almost 2 kilowatts peak, that's me, with my hair dryer in the morning, so you can see I get up at 6:40 at that day. A bit later, you see 3 peaks. That's 6 slices of toast that I have for breakfast. But the interesting thing really is not so much the peaks and that you can now see my behavior and what I do. But what for me really was interesting was the pedestal. That was my house. It was really hard to consume less energy than 180 watts. So I switched off my apples and then it was 100 watts, but still I use a lot of power. So
1 minute.
Yeah, next, okay. Then I thought if 40 million households consume 100 watts as a pedestal, then that's probably something like 2 nuclear power plants, and that got me thinking. And now it comes in the autonomy, next. So why can't I produce myself something like 500 watts, or the average 380 watts, or maybe 1 kilowatt in my household? And then I thought about fuel cells, about automotors, gas turbines, next. And I have a little drawing. So this is all future. It's not in my house yet. You can help me to build it. next, because I'm running out of time. So I think I will produce some electrical energy. Next, I will call the company E.mc², because I'm a physicist. And then I started thinking, if you have something that you can convert in matter, then it's like a currency. Next. So energy is like a currency. Next. And I think this will be the revolution. We need a new currency. This is coupled to energy. So vote for new energy. Next.
Okay.
I have it on a USB stick if you need it.
I wonder where the hell I put it around here somewhere. Sorry. Shit.
I'm sorry about that. He has the PDF slides and the movies don't work in the PDF. Rocket? Yeah, that one. Okay, it's about sniffing the Microsoft wireless keyboard. There are different wireless keyboards. It's like the 800 series and the 5000 series work with that. That's not actually a new idea what I'm doing. It's just the implementation of that on the Rocket. We are sniffing it. We're trying to sniff it. What? Slide, please. There is a saying.
Actually, just pause your time. I'm going to figure. Well, I'll let you restart because. Oh no, it's the side.
Oh, that's the problem.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. All right. We'll start you over.
Okay.
So. And you can go now.
Thank you. Okay, it's about sniffing the wireless keyboard with the Rocket. It's not a completely new idea. Travis Goodspeed and some guy I forgot the name of, he's on the last slide, already did some work. We're just implementing on the Rocket. There's the same RF chip in the keyboard as in the Rocket. It's the NRF24L01P, which has a packet on the air. It's called the Enhanced Shock Burst Packet. Actually, on the air, it looks like this. It sends a preamble before the Mac, then the Mac in a reverse format, then the packet length, an ID, which counts up to avoid duplicate packets, and then the payload, which is what the keyboard actually sends on the air. The payload looks like this. This is a stolen slide, so you get more slides for less work. That's what the keyboard actually sends. The packet is encrypted. It's encrypted with the MAC address of the keyboard, which is part of the packet in the front. That's really, really secure. And actually, half of the packet is usually 0 bytes, so you can see the MAC address again in the packet. It has a nice checksum, which is actually XOR of all the payload with FF at the end. What we are doing is what I think Travis Goodspeed figured it out. You need to know the MAC to configure the chip to actually read the packet, and you don't know the MAC. It's actually not on the bottom of the keyboard. But what you can do is there's an undocumented mode of the chip where you set the MAC to 2-byte length. And then you use the preamble, which it uses to signal that it's starting sending, which is AA or 55, depending on the first bit of the MAC. And there's noise in the front, and you just use 00 for that, because you think the air is quiet for a moment. And then you just dump it, and then you get the MAC back as packet payload from the chip. And then you use just simple counting and use the one that has been used the most, and that's probably the MAC of your keyboard, if you hit any keys. And that way you can find out the MAC, and then you can reconfigure the chip to actually listen to that MAC. You have to use the older receive format, because if you use the newer receive format, the chip will actually auto-act the packet, and then the keyboard would not work anymore. But you can just calculate the CRC yourself, which is a 16-bit CCITT, to see if you receive the packet. One problem with that whole thing is that there is a 9-bit payload length control field in there, which shifts all the bytes in the back by 1 bit, which makes it really sucky to compute a CRC and all other stuff with the packet. What we have done is we have produced 3 loadables for the Rocket. So if you have a current firmware, you can also install the loadables. There's one which is called Scan, which just goes through all the 99 channels that the chip has to listen and find the MAC of a keyboard. You just need to press the key on the keyboard continuously. If you do not insert the dongle at the in the computer, the keyboard actually for one key press will send like for 2 seconds to find the dongle, so you don't need to press that often. And it saves it to a file. There's a second loadable which reads the file with the channel and the Mac and actually sniffs the key press. And there's a very rudimentary and thing to try to inject key presses, which is like working it. You can send an A at the moment and nothing else, and that needs to be improved. There is, oh, that's, does it work? No. The next one is the video.
Yeah, it's just pause the timer. It's because I didn't copy it over from the USB key beforehand. Okay. So we'll pause your timer.
It's actually nearly the last thing, though. So. Yeah, okay. If it's not working, I can just describe it.
I could also just exit the presentation and play it.
Yeah, if you have VLC. It's also there in the backups folder. The first one, the one. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, the interesting part is on the bottom of the screen there. Yeah, we just, it's a reloadable running, scanning through the thing, and you just press the control key all the time, and then at some point it actually found the Mac and the channel. The keyboard is hopping, it can hop between four or five different channels, and it only hops if it's disturbed. So if you plug it in, it usually starts at the first one, but there are actually five, and that's the second video. No, that's a video again. The second video is showing the sniffing. So we have the channel and the Mac where the keyboard is, and we press keys, and you can see it on the rocket what you enter. It also can write the scan codes into a file on the data flash, and you can later read it if you need like shift and enter and the things that the loadable doesn't show. Two down. Yeah. I'm sorry, it's my fault. No,
it is. It's clearly my fault. You emailed them to me, and I failed to download them.
Yeah, but we emailed it like very late at night.
So, along with everybody else, so.
Yeah. No, it's not working. Just leave the small one. That's okay.
What's
left to do? Better key injection. At the moment, we can send an A if you just plugged in the dongle freshly. There's an incrementing counter. You need to deal with that. What we need is slightly better packet detection while scanning. There is also a wireless mouse from Microsoft. It uses basically the same. We need to support that. We don't yet. There is a connection setup if you press the first key after you plug in the dongle, which is 9 bytes long, and we haven't looked at it, which is probably usable if you need to inject keys to just reset the dongle to start all the counters from zero again. And we are not completely sure how the frequency hopping, the channels seem to be random. I don't know if they're programmed in at factory time. We need to look at that. And next slide, does it still work? Yeah. All the code is on GitHub, on the Rocket GitHub, also the slides, not the movies. You can reach us at the Twitter account or the email address of me or Schneider. He's also somewhere here. And thanks to Travis Goodspeed, who found out how to sniff, and Thorsten Schröder and Max Moser, who were the first I know of who analyzed the packet format, but they did it with more hardware and the more complicated setup. If you want to talk about it, I will be down at the assembly later on. Thank you.
Oh yeah, no worries.
Mm-hmm.
I thought we were supposed to get all the fail out on day one, but apparently. All right, sorry about that. Now we're ready. You've got the clicker?
Yeah, okay. I got it. Yeah.
All right, great. And 5 minutes is yours.
Well, thanks a lot, Nick. My name is Achim Klabunde. I'm working for the European Data Protection Supervisor. I hope most of you know what the Data Protection Authority is. The European Data Protection Supervisor, or EDPS, is the one authority that is supervising processing of personal data in the institutions of the EU. But that's the place I work. I'm leading a small IT specialist team there. And we are trying to look at data protection issues from a privacy, from a technology perspective. We are all observing a development in internet technology where these technologies, which are at the same time being used more and more, so for developing some applications, some services, some tools, it's mostly internet technologies with servers, with JavaScript, with all kinds of protocols, and so on. And privacy is usually not an issue for the developers of these technologies. I don't look at it rather than at a very, very late stage. So on the one hand are the data protection regulators, other regulators and the legislators like Jan-Philipp Albrecht, who spoke here yesterday, and his colleagues, who try to make better laws which improve the protection of personal data, while at the same time the developments which are developed, in particular in the big companies, are not in the sense of making privacy and data protection more real on the spot, but on the contrary, they find ways to collect more data, to collect more personal data for processing, building profiles, doing behavioral advertising, analyze our movements and our everything. And then we know it's not only ending up in a private company's data collection, but certain national security authorities in different countries then use these data sets and also use these technologies like using commercial cookies for tracking communications as well. So on the one hand, and it's not all bad will, that's the point here. Many people would be concerned and would be interested in finding out or doing something in programming on making these services and applications and protocols more privacy aware, but there's very little understanding what ways there are and what could be done to do data protection and privacy friendly programming. So where do we come in at this stage, we as the regulators? Well, on the legal and political side, data protection is often comprised in 8 rather simple principles, like you must have a legitimate reason for the processing, you must not process more data than you actually need, you must not process the data for a different purpose than the one for which you collected it, and you must delete the data once you don't need it anymore, you must keep the data up to date, you must give access to the person whose data you are processing, and some others. So these principles actually could be translated in technical programming. I mean, the best data protection principle is data minimization, because data which is not collected cannot be misused. So to create tools, applications, and so on in such a way that they don't process more data than what is actually needed would be the best way forward, but there are other ways. We are aware, and of course everybody is aware here, that hackers are usually very privacy aware, and there's plenty of things being done. Thank you. Plenty of things being done to increase privacy on the web, like with additional tools, like with Tor or proxies or VPNs or other things to protect against some ways of processing. But there's still not a way to. There's still more can be done to integrate it into the systems. And my call here today is come to me, talk to me, let's find a way of bringing the data protection expertise and the technological expertise together to address these issues and try to make better systems. Thank you.
Oh, thank God you're here. Okay, we're only 20 minutes behind. We can totally catch up.
Yeah.
Are you good to go?
Increase your brightness here.
Okay. Also, your slides also appear on the monitor right. Right.
Okay, awesome. Oh. Awesome.
Right in front of you, you also have a display.
Okay. Yeah. Great. There's nothing of value of me in these slides. So.
Okay.
Go. Warning, this is a fair warning. This talk does not necessarily express my point of view or opinions. Sometimes it doesn't look or doesn't hurt to look at yourself differently. I wrote a concept article for a not to be mentioned satirical website to be published under the topic hacker culture for you to improve. I'll also place it literally on the wiki so translators, it saves a lot of time. Hacker culture, hackerspaces, aka drama spaces, are physical places where people coming from the entire rainbow of the autistic spectrum congregate to celebrate their virginity by touching computers. Hackerspaces have been invented by the New Standards Alliance to flock leftist nerds, reasoning they will keep themselves busy arguing and contributing to endless discussions on various mailing lists with the same people. Now that the NSA is spying on all of us, hackerspaces have become obsolete. No real hacker has ever visited a hackerspace. It's all make-believe on the fantasy that there are, somewhere, white, middle-class males that can dominate everything digital you hold dear. This is false, since hackers do not leave their parents' basements. So, in fact, Hackerspaces are places for hipsters to work on social crime, making the rich richer and enslaving young developers to 80-hour work weeks in startups. Description of a hackerspace. A hackerspace is a timeshared basement. This basement can be above ground and is occupied with stainy pizza boxes, computer screens acting as light sources, and creepy, balding, unshaving, stinking man, aged 25, with a craving for porn. When entering a hackerspace, do mind that you're invading someone's living room. Privacy will be a subject. Talking about privacy, politics. The pen is mightier than the keyboard. Where hackerspaces could be politically neutral, breaking things and having fun received the left-wing stamp of approval. Skilled politicians scamming, giving the illusion that your opinion matters, meaning your opinion is their opinion. Having an opinion is easy. It makes you feel you belong somewhere. So this group continues to expand by converting losers and the forgotten into privacy-mongering crypto shouters. No nerd left behind. The activists are on a relentless, everlasting rampage to profit from other cultures, such as repurposing everything the hacker held dear, now calling it we and us. Hackers are them now. Another marketing scheme succeeded. Better comply or get ready for some hefty discussion on a pseudo-religious level with the converted. Repeat after me, I was born free. Ever thought you were joining a good cause? Think again. Activists claim to be the revolution, but if you've been the revolution for 30 years, then what are you? A dusty old watchdog at most. Needless and useless to say, hacking is about hacking, less about the consequences. Oh, and there are also hacker conferences. Those who can't do, organize. All around the world, conferences are organized so nerds can touch their hardware together, thinking they're drinking the Kool-Aid. The English disguise their failure by providing great beer. The Dutch use corporate prostitution with dubious partners to fund their events. American conferences are an excuse for watching strippers, setting the ideal community standard for women. The Germans are trying for 30 years now,
and
it's still not clear what floor you're on. Key presentations are basically a sequence of unsourced stories presented by quotable pundits making allegations. The independent crowd eats it up like a child eating candy, neglecting this ultimate form of consumerism, living the thing they despise, masturbating to their heroes. European conferences are about American subjects. American conferences are about American subjects. Europe simply doesn't count. Assange is a manager. Manning and Snowden are not trustworthy. What exactly did they hack? And more importantly, where are the 3D printed action figures? Fun fact, while hackers praised public transparency, the money side of hacker conferences is surprisingly quiet. Thank you.
Hi everyone. Good introduction to my topic. It's about real hacking, real pen testing. It's about such a database like Firebird. Who am I? My name is Alexey Osipov. I'm a web hacker, pen tester, Scott Strangelove team member, and developer of some nifty programs and honeypots. Why speaking about Firebird? For MySQL, MSSQL, Oracle, you have plenty of methods, tricks to hack the system. For example, for MSSQL you have code execution, but for Firebird you have nothing, because Firebird is only 1% of the market. Sorry, Firebird, no offense. As for pen testing, how we can hack Firebird? You obviously have SQL injections, but more often you have web service on port 3050 with default user and password, sysdb, and master key. So you can do pretty much everything. I'm not interested in Git information. I'm a tester. I'm interested in hacking the system. So I would like to, for remote code executions. Firebird has no option to read files, write files, or everything. But there is some strange backup system. You can create a arbitrary file in arbitrary location that will contain all further information for the database. So you can insert PHP shell, ASP shell, GSP shell, and execute it with the power of a web server. But there is no problem with this. You should know the exact path to the database. But Firebird goes further. It allows you to create database everywhere on the system where it has write privileges. So you can just, again, insert web shell and execute it with the power of the web server. And there is a strange effect. If anybody uses this database, this file is locked, so no one can read it. But if you just exit the interactive shell, the file is open and you can do it, can read it with the web server. And as for about different RCEs, other databases, for example, in Postgres, you can define user defined function that will execute C code on the system. Firebird allows it. You don't have to upload any file to the system. You just can load libc library and execute system, like these commands to install some backdoor. And as for Windows, there wasn't such an opportunity until, thanks to Alexander Tlyapov, who found the function WinExec that allows you, without any uploading to the host, also execute any command on the system. And for example, add user and connected via RDP. More obviously, Windows contains UNC, Unified Name something, and you can access any file on the remote location via SMB protocol. And if you can upload it to your host, you can connect and have any function that you want. But there is an approach to have NTLM authentication and SMB relays. Firebird doesn't have NTLM, but authorizes on SMB. So that's pretty much everything to obtain system privileges on the affected system, because
1 minute.
Firebird launched at the system privileges. And if you have any questions about Firebird or other SQL injections or real hacking, please find me and I will answer your questions. Thank you.
So, hello. Can anybody hear me? Okay. So we discovered that our HP laptop broadcasts or not. We will go into that later. First, the shameless self-plugging / introduction. Alex and I, we're working in network security, so RF is not really our business. We had a few colleagues that supported us. I think one of them, Daniel, is in this room. Daniel, are you there? Somewhere? No. Okay. We're also embracing nerd culture, of course, and we have to thank a non-disclosed customer for providing us lab equipment and also samples. So, how everything began. 31st of August, we saw this on Twitter. There was a Reddit posting, actually. The author told that his HP laptop actually internal microphone transmits at audio somewhere around 24 megahertz. This was actually particularly interesting for us. Here's proof. Alex retweeted it. And I was sitting in front of such a machine at that moment. So this was kind of interesting. And of course, then we had the motivation to read all sorts that were there, research into it. And we only really found this Reddit article. Here's the original. Is the author in this room? Perhaps talk to us later. We'd like to know your lab setup. This is his proof. You can see the frequency modulated signal there, which could be audio. So, yeah, and then we said, okay, we have to try this. Maybe this is working. To our setup, we had three HP Litterbooks 8460p, which is the affected model according to the Reddit article. Also, just for baselining, lots of other HP notebooks, 13-inch, 15-inch, 20, around 20 samples. And now the more interesting stuff, of course. We had the Rohde & Schwarz ESMB1 test receiver, works from 90 kHz to 2050 MHz, and a HFH2 Z2 antenna accompanying it from 9 kHz to 30 MHz. And yeah, now to the really interesting test results. Yeah, hand over to Alex for that.
Yes, we started with a sweep over the frequency range that we got from the article, which the signal was at 24 megahertz, so we swept over from 20 megahertz to 30 megahertz in 5 kilohertz increases, and we found pretty much, after the sweep, nothing. There should be a laser pointer in here somewhere. No? Sorry? Okay. You just can see a clean noise floor. We didn't see anything, so we said, okay, increase the area where we're searching in. We're going up from 20 megahertz to 40 megahertz, same stepping, looking again, and we found a peak. There's something, which was very exciting. But then we checked, and it wasn't actually decodable. It was just some noise. There will be sound samples of everything later after this talk for downloading. And then we looked around because we found some more peaks a little higher in frequency, as you can then see here, which was also not decodable. And we have also sound samples, and there was actually nothing. And to get only this 15 decibels over the noise floor, there's a slight problem, because even with all the cool setup and gear that we have, to get this kind of signal, we need to do this. And I think if you attack someone and hold the antenna around his laptop, he will notice. Maybe. So, our conclusions. Yes, we found something. There was something, but it was just too weak and blends just into the noise floor. And with our EU samples that we got from the HP notebooks, we couldn't reproduce any of these attacks. So if someone has done some more research into it, maybe with not EU samples of the devices, please contact us after the talk. Thank you.
Thanks.
Can you help us, please?
Check, check. Okay. Ja, hallo. Der Talk wird auf Deutsch sein. Mein Name ist Alex. Ich bin von Stop Watching Us Heidelberg. Mir geht es darum, dass wir seit Edward Snowden die ganzen Sachen geleakt hat, haben wir im Prinzip eine Protestbewegung in Deutschland. Und da möchte ich doch mal auch Florian Wächter danken, der Stop Watching Us Deutschland ins Leben gerufen hat und vielen anderen auch, die sich da engagieren. Aber wir haben auch ein Problem. Wir haben ein Problem dahingehend, dass es viele, viele Organisationen gibt, wie Stop Watching Us, wie beispielsweise Netzpolitik.org, wie beispielsweise Föbut oder Digital Courage, wie sie mittlerweile heißt, die nebeneinander arbeiten, die nicht miteinander arbeiten und die sich teilweise auch zerhacken, teilweise. Also meine Intention für den Talk war eigentlich, dass auf netzpolitik.org ein Artikel erschien, knapp 24 Stunden nachdem 560 Schriftsteller weltweit eine Petition veröffentlicht haben gegen die Überwachung. Und da hieß es dann auf netzpolitik.org, einfach mal die Luft anhalten. Hallo, geht's noch? Ich finde, es muss möglich sein, dass wir zusammenarbeiten. Also dieser Artikel auf netzpolitik.org war absolut vernichtend gegenüber der Initiative der Schriftsteller, weil da jemand meinte, dass die Richtung, in die die gehen, völlig falsch sei. Das mag ja sein. Man kann auch einzelne Punkte in dem Punkt kritisieren, aber ich finde, wir müssen alle zusammenarbeiten. Seien es die Schriftsteller, seien es die Netzpolitiker, auch von den Parteien. Ich sehe hier keinen Netzpolitiker von den Parteien hier auf dem Kongress. Das hat Katharina Lokun gestern schon angedeutet. Es gibt keinen Netzpolitiker von den Parteien, die hier da sind. Und wir müssen alle zusammenarbeiten, um gegen diese ganze Geschichte, die Edward Snowden seit Juli, Juni ungefähr veröffentlicht hat, anzugehen. Und das Problem ist, dass wir alle uns verhackstücken. Netzpolitik.org haut auf die Schriftsteller drauf. Dann gab es teilweise Kritiken vom CCC, die den Föbut, die Digital Courage kritisiert haben. Was soll das? Bitte, Leute, arbeitet zusammen. Es geht einfach darum, dass wir eine einzige Bewegung schaffen, die in Deutschland oder auch weltweit, mir wäre es weltweit am liebsten, aber zunächst mal in Deutschland Einigkeit zeigt. Denn wir wollen eigentlich, dass alle, wir wollen eigentlich alle dasselbe, nämlich Recht und Freiheit. Und dafür brauchen wir Einigkeit.
One minute.
Ja.
This one on this side. Ja, hallo, schön, dass ihr alle da seid. Ich bin Pingonine und bevor ich meinen Vortrag über Open Source Redaktion beginne, möchte ich noch kurz ein Statement loswerden bezüglich der Feminismusdebatte, die in den Medien und in der Presse anlässlich dieses Kongresses erneut aufgerollt werden. Und Nick, is this the camera over there for the webcast here in the corner? So, is it? Don't know.
I believe that they switch between the two depending on which angle they
okay.
can get better.
Okay, so hey ladies out there, ich würde gern euch mitteilen, dass hier lauter nette und engagierte Menschen unterwegs sind auf diesem Kongress, die mit sehr spannenden Projekten beschäftigt sind. Und ich weiß nicht, wie es euch geht, aber ich fühle mich hier immer ganz besonders sicher auf diesem Kongress. Vielleicht auch, weil ich den Rat meiner Großmutter beachte, die sagte, Kleines erst denken, dann enthüllen. Gut, und da hier auf dem Kongress Denken ganz besonders sexy wirkt, möchte ich mich auf die Inhalte konzentrieren. Ich wende mich mit einem Aufruf an die Open Source Community, was die technische Redaktion angeht. Ich bin technische Redakteurin in der Profession und aus Leidenschaft. Und technische Redakteure sind in dieser Welt dafür da, dass sie die wertvollen Ergebnisse der Entwickler in menschenlesbare Form bringen. Das heißt, die Inhalte sollen verstanden werden, sie sollen geschätzt werden und sie sollen uns bei den täglichen Arbeiten unterstützen und auch angewendet werden. Hierbei musste ich vor einigen Wochen auf einem Kongress für die technische Kommunikation lernen, dass leider der Markt der technischen Kommunikation fest in der Hand von Microsoft und Adobe liegt. Da ich gerne Linux anwende und wenn ich ehrlich bin, da ich seit einigen Jahren eigentlich ausschließlich Linux anwende, muss sich das ändern. Ich habe hier mal zusammengetragen, was ein technischer Redakteur braucht und da fängt das an mit einem Editor, der so einfach wie möglich gestaltet ist, damit Menschen, die keine Programmierkenntnisse haben, auch die technischen Inhalte erfassen können. Wir brauchen ein Content-Management-System, in dem wir Inhalte, die immer wiederkehren, wiederverwertbar sind. Die zentrale Stelle ist ein Redakteur, in dem wir Varianten, Sprachen und Layouts und die Produkte verwalten. Grafikbearbeitung ist auch sehr wichtig, weil wir ja zur Veranschaulichung immer Grafiken brauchen und zu guter Letzt ist eine abgestimmte Schnittstelle zu den Übersetzern wichtig, da wir auch global denken. Da ich die Schlacht nicht kampflos aufgeben möchte, habe ich mich in der Community mal umgesehen und zwar im World Wide Web und habe geguckt, was die Open Source Community bisher schon anbietet. Die habe ich einfach mal zusammengetragen, wobei das Linux Documentation Project am nächsten dran ist an dem, was ein professioneller technischer Redakteur benötigt. Hierzu ist auch erwähnenswert das DITA Open Toolkit, das uns auch da hilft, die Inhalte zu modularisieren und wiederverwertbar zu machen. Leider habe ich nichts gefunden in der Open-Source-Landschaft, das einen integrierten Workflow für professionelles technisches Dokumentieren anbietet. Daher habe ich eine Liste erstellt an Anforderungen, die wir technischen Redakteure an einen Open-Source-Dokumentations-Workflow haben. Hier ist nur zu erwähnen, dass alle die Werkzeuge, die ich erwähnt habe, so einfach wie möglich sein müssen, dass wir technischen Redakteure es auch bedienen können, auch wenn wir keine Programmierkenntnisse haben. Und es ist wichtig, dass wir so flexibel wie möglich bleiben und auch global denken. Deshalb an dieser Stelle mein Aufruf an die Community. Bitte meldet euch bei mir, falls ihr Dokumentationssysteme kennt, die ihr schon benutzt. Ich bin leider nicht fündig geworden nach einem kompletten Dokumentationsfortflow und ich bin hier auf dem Kongress unterwegs. Bitte sprecht mich an oder ihr könnt mich auch auf dieser E-Mail-Adresse erreichen. Und vielleicht bietet sich ja an, auch ein eigenes Open-Source-Projekt für die technische Redaktion ins Leben zu rufen. Dankeschön.
Okay. Hi, my name is Christian, or also Obelix, and I want to talk about 3D printing in art and how that the 3D printer can be more than just a tool. So, does this work? Okay, does it maybe take some time to load? I don't know. Okay. I will try to talk, but if you don't understand me, just look at the slides when they come. The thing is, I wanted to use the 3D printer in other ways and connect it to artwork, because for the moment, as I see it, the 3D printer is only a tool you use. So you have 3D art, and you print it, and it becomes solid. That's nice, but how? Why can't you carve it with a hand or stuff like this? So the challenge is that the printer is linked to the process and takes part in the artwork. So for this, I want to present some artworks I found or things I participated in, so you get some ideas. This is just, I just want to show some stuff and give you ideas and inspiration. One thing that is really nice with 3D printing that you have a way to make errors visible in a physical way. So the software error, if it appears normally, you can see it, you can feel it. You can see it, but you can feel it. And with a 3D printer, you can feel software errors. And you can use this for art. So that's really nice. And other things you can do, you can also use the 3D printing hardware to produce art, like making music or attaching an LED to make some light painting. Oh yeah. So first thing you can do is play with the printing parameters. So here is an example picture of a wooden filament where the temperature has been changed during the print. So you can make patterns and colorize it. I don't know if it already exists, but there may be filaments that change color with the temperature. So that's really nice stuff. And another thing you can do is build stuff that can only be built in a 3D printer, like this gear, which came out directly like this, and it's impossible to disassemble it or assemble it by hand. So this could be, you can develop new art forms and build objects that were impossible to build before you had a 3D printer. So to go back to the software errors, this is one artwork I participated in from Peter Weibel. He scanned sculptures and transformed it like the objects have been modified by data errors. It's like when you watch a TV screen, the screen lines have been shifted. And so this is represented in these 3D prints. What you can do too with printing is scanning people or making action figures, scan your visitors from the museum, or build little figurines like this, which go on a wedding cake. So you have a lot of options and possibilities. Next topic, you can do sound art. So printers have stepper motors, so they make sounds. And you can there are some scripts which can transform MIDI files into G-code files, and then you can hear the printer makes teacher's music or something like this. And the nice thing would be if you were able to make a real successful print and at the same time play some music. Or you can even, there someone has printed a vinyl record, that's really funny. Next thing like you can do, which is really nice, is street art. If you have a mobile printer, why not go somewhere and like this guy prints parts which go into stones or walls. Last year you had a spray can and you sprayed your name on the wall, and now you have a mobile printer and you print like bricks you can put in holes in the walls. And crowd art. You can combine the worldwide 3D printers, like here at Print2Peer. Everybody prints a model and they get assembled to a big pattern and that makes artwork. So these are the possibilities you have. If you have more questions, my name is Obelix. You can find me in the wiki or call me on the decked phone. I'm at the 3D printing assembly in assembly room 3, and you can come by if you want. I have a 3D scanner, and we can do 3D scans of your body to, I don't know, make action figures or stuff like this.
Maybe start at the beginning.
Okay, and this is a 15-minute yep. lightning talk. You've got everything ready. You're good. You're good to go.
Yep.
Okay, great. So we'll reset the timer for 15 minutes, and go.
Hi everyone. My name is Luca. I'm just a university student, and it's my first time at the Congress. Nice to meet you all. I'm going to talk about my master thesis project, which is FERNRIN. It's basically a transport encryption authentication protocol. The emphasis is on the authentication authorization part. It's a work in progress. I've started just a couple of months ago. I only have a couple thousand lines of code, so it's not yet working. Why do we need yet another transport protocol? After all, you just need to choose the one, the transport protocol you need for your application, add an encryption, add the authentication layer, and repeat it for each kind of transport that you need. For example, for messaging, you need reliable transport. For multimedia, you might need other unreliable. So there's a lot of stuff there, and you need to combine them all. With FERNRIN, my aim is to have a single project that they can use for everything, and that includes authentication in a federated environment. At the transport level, we see that FERNRIN is a UDP-based protocol, but I'm designing it in such a way that you don't actually need the UDP part. It mimics a lot the SCTP protocol, in all its features, so it's message-oriented. You don't need to worry about the beginning and the end of your messages. You have multi-stream, reliable, unreliable, ordered, unordered deliveries, all kinds of stuff, basically. And every feature is per stream, so you can have a single stream for reliable and a stream for unreliable transmission and things like that. Looking at the packet structure is something like this. We have a connection ID, so it's so we can quickly identify your connection, and even if you change IP address in the meanwhile, things like that. Some padding and the streaming header, which is the header that we need to for your data. It can be repeated multiple times in the packet. This is the unencrypted version. The encrypted and authenticated version adds a couple of more lines of header, but the dimension depends on the algorithm that you use for authentication, for example. Looking more closely at the padding, we have USB padding in two different places at the packet level, because we need, for example, for encryption to have a specific size of the packet, and also in the stream. The goal is to randomize it a little bit so that traffic analysis is on packet dimension, on transmitted data, is even more difficult. It needs some testing, but I think it can be tweaked out. Looking at the connection setup, we have a four-way handshake with C-cookie style, like SCTP does. It includes, however, some public key transmission so that we can do key exchange during the initial protocol handshake. It's a federated environment, so sometimes we might have slightly longer connection setup times, but I think the number of round-trip times is pretty low as it is. There is also a Stone-like protocol for direct client-to-client communications. Everything is planned, of course. Looking at what you need to do to set up a connection, for example, to example.com, you query for a TXT record, fenrir.example.com, which is a binary, base85 encoded, which includes everything you need. The public key, the UDP ports, the IP addresses for load balancing, all that kind of stuff. The reason I do this is because, especially in DNSSEC, every record needs its own signature. If we have a single record with all the information, we have a single signature, and we can keep everything in a single UDP response, a single packet response. Also, since everything is based on the name service system, you have complete control over it, which means that you don't have to worry about certificate authorities and things like that. In fact, it's not based on NIX 509. You just need to generate your public key and put it in the DNSSEC, as we have seen. So no public key infrastructure management. No, you don't have to pay anyone for the certificate and stuff like that. Once you have the public key, you can go forward with the key exchange, which is very similar to SSL TLS, even though it's not exactly the same. Perfect full secrecy is enforced for both anonymous and authenticated connections. Once we've done the key exchange, we can work on the authentication. The big feature is delayed authentication. Basically, a single connection can be upgraded or downgraded from anonymous to authenticated without having to set up a new connection again. It's a federated environment, so your username will be likely your email. And as in all federated environments, you have the authentication server, service, and client, which interact together, but the authentication server and service can be put together in a single package if you don't really need all the infrastructure. The federated protocol is something that I designed myself after studying all the various possibilities, because I wanted to have something token-based and without timestamps. This means that we need a couple of round-trip times more to check for the freshness of the token, but we don't have clock cinching in between any node in the network. Everything works Kerberos style, so on your device you will have a client which manages all the token and authorizations for all the applications. Since we have this setup, we can also authenticate the client, which means that we're authenticating the device. So we can have some nice per-device account management. For example, on the same account, you can have that your computer can access your bank account, but not your phone, while the account is the same, and things like that. Apart from authentication, we also have authorization, meaning that a single token is tied to a single specific authorization. Each service needs to have a service lattice, an authorization lattice, which is basically a graph going top to bottom, where top is the biggest authorization and bottom we have the least authorization. A single token is tied, for example, to the modify authorization and given to the client. The client can then use this token to give reading authorization, for example, to your applications, but not write authorization, because that is on top of modifying the lattice. The downside is that we have to transfer the lattice between the various players in this protocol. That can be deferred, of course, but it still means like we have a 2 kilobytes of transfer for that lattice. which means like two packets in a user setup. I also want to implement some multicast support for both reliable and unreliable transmission. The idea is simply to have a multicast transmission for everyone, and then a lot of unicast streams, unicast connections for the retransmission of lost data. It needs some thinking because there are lots of things that can go wrong, especially when not all clients have the same bandwidth. But I think it can be done. And this is the one of the other biggest features, proxy support at the protocol level. Basically, the biggest disadvantage of TLS and SSL connections is that you cannot cache the content. You always have to ask at the server for new content, even if it is the same. If you want a proxy, that proxy needs to manage also your certificate authority, which means that it's not such a secure setup anymore. With this idea, it means that each service also needs to explicitly tell the proxies and the network in general what content can be cached and for how long. And then the proxy at your local level or ISP level can cache that encrypted and authenticated content, and you get the decryption and authentication key from the service. So you're always sure that the content is up to date and verified. That's it, basically. I'm just at the beginning. Code is being done these days. As I told you, I just started a couple of months ago. Everything is in C++ 11, and those are the details. It's my master thesis, so I cannot ask too much help, but I'm here because I want to ask as many comments, as many ideas from you. I need some feedback from what you would like to see here, what you don't like about it, how it can be changed. As far as now, I've only thought about this myself. So the more the brains, the better the project. That's it. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone. While they're trying to set up the next talk, we're from the Infodesk. Those are our supervisors, Martin and Socky. Give them a hand. We're basically trying to give you all the information you need. But yesterday, we had a different mission. Last night, Nick was kind enough to spend a shift with us at the Infodesk. And he was dumb enough to think that we couldn't raise 512 euros in donations.
That we can't.
So he promised us if we raise 512 euros in donations in return for stickers, he would wear a hoodie today. For the whole day, just to make that sure. So Nick,
so at what point did you actually raise when did you actually make it? Because I thought the deal was that it had to be done by last night, and by last night at 4 it hadn't been done.
But by last night 6 it had. So Nick, would you be kind enough to read the number on the bottom here, please?
540 euros for the Angels after party.
Well, thank you everyone for your donations. All we Angels appreciate it all goes to our after party, and it goes into Nick wearing a yellow hoodie for the rest of the day.
Just do I get to keep the tie?
Does he get to keep the tie? Yeah. All right. So, thank you. So there were requests on Twitter how much it would cost to Nick to actually wear a jeans for a day. Yeah. We're not going to do this year, but well, Nick has experience with like hoodies. He also wore a Nicholas suite, a Santa suite. So perhaps next year we can ask him to do that, or not.
I thought I was going to wear a black hoodie, not a yellow one, which you could probably see from you.
Thank you very much,
great.
Nick.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. All right, and thank you all for your donations. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. 5 minutes. I'm very happy to share with you Fairphone. It's out. We have the first 1,000 shipped, and a lot of people here in the audience, there's some of them that are still waiting for their Fairphone. I want to share with you the story about Fairphone. A few years ago, we started to think about our e-waste, all these nice gadgets we have, all the stuff that we have, but what is the footprint of that on our Earth? A next step would be also, where's the thing here? Can I go back? Yeah. Also, we know the stories about the conflict minerals that are in our phones. They're mined in Congo. They're being paid for warlords, and we have no clue in our normal phones where these conflict minerals come from. So there is no way that you now can buy a phone that is fair in the way it deals with these minerals. Let alone about the working conditions and the whole impact it has on the workforce, but also on the people and child labor, all the kind of really bad stuff that you don't want to be part of. So there have been great documentaries about this, Blood in the Mobile, and all these documentaries ended with the story that there is no alternative. So we tried to work with the bigger companies. We went to all of them and we started to discuss if they could change their production chain, if they could make a step in that whole improving their production chain. But they all told us that some of them want to do that, but they're not able to do it. It's there are too many things to do. So that moment we decided if there's no alternative, they don't want to feel guilty, we should start to make it happen. And that's where the company Fairphone started. So it's an offspring from a research project. So we started to think like, okay, if we want to produce, we have to first go to the minerals. Where are the good minerals? Are there mines that are fair and that they have good working conditions? Can we go for factories? Can we negotiate working conditions that are better? And not only here in the West, but also in China. Can you discuss working conditions, working hours, minimal pay wages, those kind of things? So you need some contract power. So at the moment we realize that we have to start, and then we find out how to make a fair phone. And this is possible because 5,000 people trusted us to make this phone. They said, we will pay you in advance, 325 euros, which is really something to just ship to a company that never made a phone before and only is in existence over half a year. So it's quite a we took up a lot of responsibility. Me, actually, it is Bas van Abel and his team who couldn't be here today because they're busy shipping these phones to all the people. They're totally committed to the support and to the whole logistics at the moment. But we were able to make a lot of improvements in this phone. So it's not only working conditions. We know how to find some fair minerals, not all of them. So we don't say this is the fairest phone on Earth. Well, let's say it's the fairest phone on Earth. You can make a very fair phone which is really big, but then it doesn't need these conflict minerals. So all the tiny gadgets needs minerals that are very conductive. So that's why we put so much pressure on our minerals. But it's also working conditions. It's also repairable. You can open it up. So the whole concept of if you can't open it, you don't own it is of course also part of this whole concept of the phone. We work together with Quimcorp to make a Fairphone operating system that will be shared online with you and all the widgets. We were working on a roadmap to make next steps for the operating system. It's rootable and all that kind of stuff. And it has dual SIM, which is for some people maybe the reason to buy a Fairphone. What I really like is that we have this phone not only in the key community. There are people also very, very normal users that don't want to be troubled by stories of putting their own operating system on a phone. So we bring it with an Android client, and you can work with it immediately. So we have this, in this 25,000 people now bought a phone. So we will have to ship these phones in the coming weeks. And it will be launched in Germany, in the Netherlands, in Austria and England. And there are another 15,000 people now ordered the phone, so we have to figure out how to make the next 20,000. But most important is that we can really improve step by step the way these kind of gadgets are being made, and that we can also influence companies that say it's not possible. If it's possible for us to have fair working conditions and some of the steps already in fair mining and recyclability and open hardware, well, open hardware would be a long stretch for some companies. But we would be able, if we can do this, then the larger companies have much more contract power and they can't hide anymore. They can't say it's not possible. So Fairphone will be very successful if all phones are become more fair. And we hope we will succeed in that. Thank you very much.
Hello. My talk will be on increasing the speed of time-based blind SQL injection. Where is this? Here. I start with a small introduction, and then I come to the main subject of speeding it up. SQL injection is the number one of the top 10 web vulnerabilities because it's really dangerous. You can dump stuff out of the databases, you can get password hashes, you can change the databases. It's a really powerful vulnerability if you leave it open in your web applications. The code you see on the slide is a very simple example of vulnerable PHP script. Because it just takes the input from the web page and appends it to the SQL statement. And if you take the second line and put that into the web form and send it to the database, you see the resulting query in the bottom. The red stuff is which comes from the malicious input. So it takes a select statement, looks for a user, and after that it takes the user with the ID 23 and changes his type to admin. So somebody can make himself an admin in a web application, without being allowed to. There are several different kinds of SQL injection. The classic SQL injection is one where you can, if you want to retrieve data, you can combine several tables, and you, like in this case, you ought to see a list of articles, but you can combine that with logins and passwords from users. And this is a very the best situation for an attacker because it's very fast. You can see like 20 articles and 20 password hashes next to it. There's another kind of SQL injection, which is Boolean SQL injection. There you don't see the result of the query. You don't see the password hash on the web page, but you can maybe sometimes send a query and on certain condition you can raise an error, like there appears an error message on the web page, or if it's false, there doesn't appear an error message. And with this kind of SQL injection, you can still retrieve information because you can send queries and ask specific questions, like is the first character of the password hash of the admin user, is it below 64, then you get the error message. If it's above, you don't get the error message. And using lots of queries like this, you can use binary search and you can narrow down on the first character, like is it below 64, is it below 32, is it higher than 48, and in the end you get the character. And you need in average 7 requests per ASCII character to download one character. So obviously you need lots of queries to download the whole string or multiple hashes from users. So this is a lot slower than the classic SQL injection, but you can speed it up a bit because you can do it multi-threaded. You can ask several questions at the same time. Then another kind of SQL injection is time-based. There you don't have an indication if your query is true or false because it's programmed a bit better. You don't get the error message. It's caught or catched before. But if you can send an SQL statement, you can use, for example, the sleep command to make the database wait some seconds before it returns on certain conditions. So you can again use binary search, and if it's true, you return the web page immediately. If it's false, you wait 2 seconds, and then you can see from the time it takes until you get the web page if it was true or false. There are databases which don't have a sleep command. There you have to make a tiny denial of service by making the database make lots of calculations, like 200,000 iterations of this multiplications, so it's, yeah, well, it's a short denial of service. And this is a really, really slow method of dumping data out of a database because, well, you still have lots of send lots of requests per character, and it's also error prone because there might be a network lag and you don't know if this database is waited for 2 seconds or just there was a packet loss or some other reason for which you got the packet later. And you cannot really make it multi-threaded on databases where you have to do the denial of service calculations. You can't do it anyway because you cannot distinguish between the several requests, and in other in databases like MySQL, Oracle, or Postgres where you can use the sleep command, it's still difficult to do it multi-threaded because, well, it's just hard to get the different timings right. And there's a common pitfall if you compare those normal Boolean SQL injections and the time-based. The pitfall is that if you have only a hammer as a tool, every problem looks like a nail. And the common stuff of Boolean SQL injection and time-based SQL injection is that you ask questions, like is it higher or lower than 64, and you get the answer of true or false. But the big difference is in time-based that questions don't take equally long. If you send an ask question which is true, you get it immediately. If it's false, it takes longer. So it's not necessarily the best way to take the binary search from the Boolean SQL injection and use it for the time-based SQL injection. So I made an example to compare the speed. If I want to get a string which is 1, 2, 3, 4, and I know in advance that this is just the 4 possibilities. And then I need to send 2 requests per number, because I ask is it below 2? If it's below 2, I ask is it 1 or 2? And in total, I need 8 requests to get those 4 numbers. In if I try linear search, I try to check every single combination. I ask, is it a 1? Is it a 2? Is it a 3? Is it a 4? And if I use this, I need 9 requests to to get the same result. So it's slower. If I see at the speed of the requests, I have 6 negative answers where I have to wait long and 3 answers which are fast. But what I could do is I change the way I ask. I don't ask, is it a 1? But I ask, is it not a 1? And this is similar to the game show What's My Line, or in German, Heiteres Berufsraten, where the people which ask questions also need to avoid the answer no, because if they ask 10 times and get a question with no, they lose. So we also need to take care that we ask in a way that we don't get the negative answers. So we turn it around, we ask, is this not a 1? Is this not a 2? Is this not a 3? So just by flipping the logic of it, we get the answer in 3 slow and 6 fast requests. And this is also, let me go to the next slide. And if you calculate this, if you compare this, you have for binary search, 4 fast, 4 slow. For linear search, you have 6 fast and 3 slow. And if you use normal default settings of SQL map, for example, and normal web application, you get the positive result in 100 milliseconds and the negative in 1 second. And if you compare this, it takes 4.4 seconds for binary search and 3.6 seconds for linear search. Also, you save to do the tunnel denial of service if you have a database which doesn't offer a sleep command, which is quite handy because you do administrator might realize that the load of the database goes up because he has to do all the calculations. And you can make an equation out of the amount of fast and slow requests which need, and then you can calculate the break-even point, like how fast a slow compared to a fast query has to be to make linear search faster. And for 4 choices, this is twice. If the fast response comes twice as fast as the slow response. And even for 8 choices, it's still 3.2 times difference between slow and fast to make the linear search faster. And usually you have
1 minute.
Didn't I have 2 times 5 minutes?
Yes, you've been speaking for 9 minutes.
Oh, I'm slow. I made a small patch to SQL map, and I increased the speed to get the sample string from 120 seconds to 103 seconds, just using some simple patch. The patch should be available on the wiki afterwards. The best way to mitigate this is to not put your passwords just hashed in the database. You should also encrypt them. Because you saw in the Adobe leak, where they leaked 150 million passwords, that not a single one of them got cracked. They got leaked because the passwords hint were dumped as well. But if you would encrypt the database, the passwords, and put the key not in the database, but put it somewhere else in a file, then you can get the hashes, but they are encrypted. Still, you should also hash the password. You should salt them, hash them, and encrypt them. And then if people get the database via SQL injection or from some dump or whatever, they still cannot crack your passwords. This protects even lousy passwords. If the password is 12346, somebody will crack it. Even if you use pbkdf 10,000 cycles, at some point he will crack the lousy password. But if the password hash is encrypted, he will not be able to guess even the lousiest password. And you could also encrypt the password hints as well. This is something Adobe has done wrong. Because if you have encryption algorithm anyway in your web application, just encrypt all the password hints, and then you are done with this as well. Okay. Thank you for listening.
Did you have an additional
You put the slides on the wiki? Or?
Yeah, I will.
Okay, so I jumped over some slides. They will be on the wiki. The patch is also on the USB stick. You can put it on the wiki.
Yes.
And then you can try for yourself the speed difference. Okay, thanks.
Okay, great. Sorry about that.
Okay, and yes, as a reminder, please don't forget to stay as close to the microphone as is comfortable. And what's on the screen is on a display right beneath you. Can you see that okay? Oh, can you see the display?
Yeah,
okay, great. 5 minutes. And now we're back to 5 minute talks for the rest of the session. Whenever you're ready, 5 minutes is yours.
Okay, welcome everyone. I'm glad to present you the easiest way to encrypt your communication. Not only Glenn Greenwald, but most of the people fail to establish a secure communication. Therefore, the usability is the most important challenge for encryption. And PryBlock.com is an approach to gain easy asymmetric encryption from user to user without the need of installing a program or storing keys. My name is Finn Siebert. I'm working as an IT consultant on part-time base, and on the other part, I'm working on this approach. In my diploma thesis, I've described this idea and implemented a prototype. So these guys are Alice, Bob, and Clara. Okay, I'm starting with the last slide. You can find further information on for this project at PryBlock.com. And we have the chance to discuss this idea in more detailed and more intensive right after this lightning talks. We will meet in front of this hall. For example, discuss how to generate two random numbers with JavaScript, and we are looking forward to find some people who want to join us to start a proper non-profit open source project. Okay, let's see how it is working. How can Alice send encrypted message to Bob without installing a program or without storing public keys? So, the answer is we have a web browser-based online social network service with built-in encryption, and the encryption is implemented in JavaScript, and this is executed local in the web browser. Okay, and Alice can open this website like she opens websites a dozen times a day, and so it would be easy for her. Okay, and then she has to check the website if this is a correct site. For example, while she's using Firefox, she has to push Control and U and check the source code against an hash value. Okay, one might say checking the source code of a website every time you access the website and check it against a hash value isn't a good usability. That's right. But for practical purposes, it will be enough if she only spot checks the website, or if only some users spot check the websites for every now and then. And also, there could be a browser plugin which checks the site automatically every time she accesses the site. Okay, we use an online social network service, so we can store the public keys and, of course, also the encrypted private keys in the network. So all Alice has to remember is just her password and a pseudonym to access the website. Okay, how to send an encrypted message? Okay, when Alice is sending a message, the network automatically fetches the public key from the network. It checks the public key, and it encrypts the message with the public key. And the interesting thing here is how to check the public key without storing it locally.
1 minute.
When Alice decides to trust Bob's key, a hash value from the public key concatenate with the password were stored in the network. So the carrier of the network is, of course, able to delete this public key, but he isn't able to change the public key without knowing of Alice's passwords. So, and that is the important thing here. Okay, reading a message is straightforward. just fetch the encrypted private key from the network, decrypt the key with your password, and decrypt the message with the private key. So, okay, last slide again. I hope I see a few of you after the lightning talks. And thanks for your attention.
And you just have the one slide, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Great.
Hello, I'm Kai E. I work on the Mozilla NSS Security Library. Most web and internet users rely on the security of SSL TLS in one way or the other. Major internet client software like browsers are built to make it practical to immediately get a base level of security without requiring user action or configuration. You visit a website or connect to a TLS server, and the software makes a decision whether the connection is secure or not by performing a verification of the certificate presented by the server. This simplicity for the user is achieved by using trusted third parties and granting them the right to confirm that a service key belongs to the owner of a domain or an organization. The trusted third parties are called certificate authorities. Browsers and other software ship with a list of CAs that are trusted by default. The problem is, a CA could be hacked, for example, DigiNota, as we have seen, or their powers could be abused secretly for targeted attacks. That's speculation. That means each CA could be seen as a potential global point of failure because, as of today, nearly all CAs are allowed to make trust assertions for any domain. That's why some people claim that TLS is broken, but nevertheless, it's still being used all the time, and most internet users must rely on it. We are still waiting for a good solution to solve the problem that each CA is a potential point of failure. Instead of relying on only one trust assertion, the certificate from a CA, we need a way to get one or more additional opinions whether a given certificate looks like the correct one. Several other projects have already attempted to help solve this issue. For examples are Convergence, Perspective, Dropbear, Certificate Transparency, Mekai, etc. But none of them is widely deployed yet. That's why we must continue to search for a solution that might be sufficiently practical to work for everyone, or at least the majority. Here is another design to solve the problem, which I call Detector. It reuses the idea to use notaries that probe a TLS server from multiple perspectives. It attempts to compare the server's key that we obtain when connecting to it using a direct route with the server's key obtained when connecting from different places in the network. However, because I want to avoid having to trust someone else, I propose that we create software that allows everyone to be their own notary. This requires that you are able to connect to servers from multiple different locations on the internet. Most users don't have that ability easily. However, there's a trick. We can use the Tor network, see torproject.org. We don't use the anonymizing feature of the Tor network. The idea is to use it as a proxy, so we can connect on our own to the destination server from multiple places in the world and check for consistency. If we see consistency, we continue to connect. If there's inconsistency, we block the connection and return an error to the application level code. The idea of the Detector.io project is to create general purpose library code that can be integrated into any internet client software. There's one attack scenario that it's difficult to detect by the client if the attacker is physically in front of the target, because then all connections can be hijacked, even if the connections going through the Tor network used for probing. In order to solve this scenario too, it is necessary that administrators of websites take action. I want to encourage each operator of a TLS server to monitor their own server by connecting through the Tor network from multiple locations and check for unexpected keys. I've started to work on monitoring software for this purpose, and you can already download a beta version from the project page at detector.io. If you want to help with this project, please contact me or come to the workshop. At 3 p.m. today, immediately after this talk, there will be a 30-minute workshop in Hall F, like Freedom. I will present the design in more detail, I will explain the proposed implementation strategy, and I'm looking for people to help. If you are interested or if you'd like to hear more details, please join. For those of you who are watching on the stream and cannot join the workshop,
1 minute.
I've published the slides that I'll use during the workshop on the project website. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Svoli and I code demos.
Oh, Svoli, just adjust the microphone.
Hi, I'm Svoli and I code demos. I want to dedicate this talk to a friend of mine who's very sick and who asked me this question I'm going to answer in the first place. So, I was showing us something like this. This is four Zeno curves laid over each other. But that's not the exciting part. The exciting part is that this was displayed using some very ancient hardware. It's just an old console with only very limited resources. And her question was, yeah, this looks nice, but why are you doing this? To me, this question separates in two parts. Why are you doing demo coding in general? And why are such a limited platform? The first answer is very obvious. I do it because, to me, it's fun. Let me compare this to the real life. To my parents, garden work is fun. To me, it isn't. Well, why am I doing this on the retro hardware? It's fun to me because, not despite of the limitations, but because of the tight restrictions I've got there. Now let's take a step back, and I say what we're doing here at Coding Demos is digital art. Some kind may be compared to graffiti. So, as in real life, what purposes are there? It's just to entertain the viewer. It has no real direct purpose. On retro hardware, I wanted to stick to this graffiti theme. Think of it, you're a graffiti artist, and you've forgotten or lost your spray cans at home, and all you've got a nice idea, you want to get it through, and all you've got is the nail polish from your girlfriend. So you start using this nail polish to get something done, and it looks nice. Someone stops by and said, wait, it looks cool. You've done this with nail polish? Wow. So exploring this technique, you get the point that you can do some things with the nail polish you can't do with the spray can. So this is my point of this. And in the third place, to me, it's like playing a game. In real life, some people have not fun on solving crossword puzzles or Sudokus, but to create them. And to me, it's also, or demo coding again, is like creating something like this. When I get at home, I don't watch TV, but I code. And it's much more fun to do because once I get done, I just haven't seen something, but I've done something that I can show. And this also applies to the, for me playing a game on retro hardware, hacking or demos on retro hardware is like playing some kind of tower defense game. You've got very limited resources, like in this game, Plants vs. Zombies. You've only got very limited resources on places to put your plants on. You've got just a low amount of currency to buy your plants that's going to defend you. You've got only a few plants you've got to do the work for you. And all these different kinds of limitations are also applying to coding on retro hardware. You've got very limited resources, and you've got to explore the limits and make the best of it. And of course, the biggest part of it is the release. When you've really got something that looks cool and you want to release it, you're not going to put it on the net, but there are big parties that where people come together and let their code compete. You can think of it as championships of demo coding, but they are called parties for a case because they are really big parties. They are fun, and the main theme there is the real party is outside, so they stick together, they chat, they have really big fun, they're enjoying each other's. I invite you to come there. There are several parties in Germany each year, and you can just stop by and watch the parties. There are parties that...
1 minute.
That they have, you've got the really of a factory. The whole one whole wall is the place where the Beamer projects the demo at. You've got really nice PA. It's really big fun. If you want to just step into this, there's a nice film called Moment 2, which describes the demo scene. It's really nice, 90 minutes to watch and enjoy. So here's my conclusion: why I'm demo coding, because I can. Thank you.
Okay, and I believe for these last two sessions for today, the presenters are going to be using their own hardware. We have a presentation from the guys doing a wonderful, awesome, awesome conference in Russia, which I promise I will attend one of these days. And then we have an extra, extra special treat at 3 o'clock, right after they're done with their presentation. Tomorrow's Lightning Talks, I know the wiki is down right now. I hope it comes back up, but I will be emailing everybody. I believe at this point we are full. I know the only thing we have left are 3-minute slots, but if you would like to, if you want to just see if there's a possibility, you can always email me, 30c3@nickfarr, N-I-C-K-F-A-R-R. .org, and I will try to slide you into the schedule tomorrow. I'm going to also try to get a little bit more time tomorrow, just because of what was going on with the wiki and everything else like that. And I will be, once a mirror is up, if the wiki is not up, I will be tweeting that out. My Twitter address is nickfarr. And before I pass it off to the last two presenters, I want to give a huge round of applause, but before that, the guys who run the video, the people running the cameras, and the people running the audio, this is the hardest shift at any C3, because you have dozens of presenters who are doing all sorts of crazy things, going around every which way, and sometimes speaking a little bit too close to the microphone as well. And they are brilliant experts at adjusting for all of that. So can we please give the audiovisual angels a huge, huge round of applause? They always do an excellent job at making me look good. And so without any ado, we're not going to be timing the last two presenters, but they said they would take no longer than 10 minutes, and I trust them, so take it away.
Hi, everybody. We are one of organizers of Positive Hack Days conference. This is a hackers conference which takes place in Moscow, Russia. And today we want to tell you about one of our activities, which we called The Labyrinth. You know, there's a lot of activities during the conference, like Capture the Flag, like HackQuest, and so on. But this year, we wanted to create something new. And we asked a question to ourselves. What if we unite hacking challenges and Disneyland stuff? Because hacking challenges is great, Disneyland stuff is awesome. And together, these things will be great also. And this way, Labyrinth was born. First of all, we have only an idea, and we need a plan. We create a big shopping list. We selected a number of most cinemas activities from our favorite hackers movies, spy movies, and so on. Described all specifications of stuff we want to present and what we need to do.
So here is a list of activities we have chosen. Unfortunately, I don't have time to describe them all. There will be a short video demonstrating. We wanted to make a separate room for each activity. To do so, we needed to fill a structure of how can we build such a construction. There were three main principles we are going forward with. The design should be modular. It should be easy to build and prototype things inside the rooms, so we can check a lot of hypotheses before building the final edition. So this is how rooms looks take together, and the whole labyrinth consists of 5 rooms with dimensions of 3 meters by 2 and by 2.5 meters. They have 3 doors, one for entrance, one for exit. So they can, so one leads into another, and one service door. So if something goes wrong inside the room or we need to refresh some stuff, we can stealthy fix it. Also, we needed a prototype in a room to build all the interior design, all the challenges which should be in the final release in each room. So we gave our blueprints and our 3D models to our contractor, who in 2 weeks, have assembled us the first room, which then was used in the on the venue.
When we get the first room, there is a lot of stuff from our shopping list already arrived to our office, and we just start to play it. For example, here we are playing with a device which helps you to find hidden cameras, and here's our fog machine and lasers. And then after we play with this stuff, we start to solder a lot. We solder a lot of pin pads, Arduino stuff, motion detectors, but most difficult for us was build laser equipment for laser-based alarm system. And with the best traditionals of Apple company, we built nifty boxes for each our device. Here's not nifty boxes, but here's our first prototypes of bomb and laser-based alarm system. Here is our prototype of social engineering contest, build it on some table. And here's the first prototype of laser-based alarm system with a fork inside the room. This stuff is my favorite one. Here we are testing motion detectors. Here's Alex testing lasers.
So, as it says, it never went easy. We've faced a lot of problems building the stuff. We had a lot of troubles positioning the lasers because first design of the room was lacked some rigidity. We almost have some legal problems with radio bugs, also 3D models not always render perfect into real life. We first time made such complex by our measures Arduino projects, and without any complex building experience, it was really hard for us to meet our deadline, the start of the event. After all, 4 months later, after all the preparations, we finally got the whole construction running at the venue. Here you can see a small animation or time lapse how it was built on site. And next, we want you want to show you some video. It's a part of PhDay's documentary filmed at the conference. And it also contains some feedback. I hope there won't be any troubles with audio.
And what is really special here, and I've not seen it at another conference this cool, is the capture the flag, especially with the labyrinth and stuff. This is really cool, and I'm really eager to go with another, with my own group through that maze.
The labyrinth thing, right? Where you have like the different rooms that you go through and different puzzles and such. So that's actually something else I've never heard of before, so that's definitely unique to hear.
Отдельный огромный конкурс у нас в этом году, это был лабиринт, который вошел в Capture the Flag соревнования и просто присутствовал в качестве такого элемента шоу.
The project was amazing, it was very well executed.
Лабиринт — это зрелищный фановый конкурс, состоящий из нескольких заданий. На каждое задание было определено по одной комнате. Соответственно, всего их было 5. В первой комнате участникам необходимо было обойти датчик движения. Вторая комната — участникам необходимо было привить навыки социальной инженерии. В третья предлагала участникам почувствовать себя героями шпионского фильма и обойти каким-то образом цивилизацию, построенную на световых лучах лазера. Четвертая комната заключала в себе задание на поиск эмуляторов закладных устройств. И пятая комната, заключительная, представляла собой комнату локпикинга, которую участникам необходимо было проявить и показать всем свои навыки по открыванию замков отмычками. По завершению прохождения всех комнат участникам предлагалось обезвредить бомбу за ограниченное количество времени. А при неуспешном разминировании бомбы взрывалась огромная какая-то пушка, и в любом случае все были счастливы и рады.
So we hope you liked it. We think building some physical stuff, some real-world challenges on Hacker Conference is awesome, and we advise everybody of you to make something similar or even more interesting on your conference. So thank you.
Oh, and just one quick reminder, when is PH Days, or when is the next edition? Just to remind everybody. Oh, yeah.
It'll be second half of May, 2014. They help me, 21 and 22nd of May.
Okay, awesome, thank you.
Start the computer before.
Yeah, so those of you wondering, when I took over the Lightning Talks 4 years ago, everybody asked me, so why are you being so harsh about this slide thing? And this is exactly the reason. Because if you bring your own laptop, yeah, go ahead, a round of applause for that. I mean, there are certain exceptions that are made, obviously, for certain demos or certain presentations, but this is the main reason why. Slides and documentation in 95% of cases has to be given way ahead of time. Are you ready to go?
Just a second.
Okay, yep. It's primarily because submitting your slides in advance and submitting slides as a very simple deck eliminates a lot of the problems, and it helps us keep a program that keeps on moving. Because if we have a 5-minute talk and then a 3-minute break for figuring out hardware and presentation stuff, and then a 5-minute talk and 3 minutes for presentation hardware, it's just hard to move with a program like that. But if you have 5 minutes, few seconds, 5 minutes, few seconds, it seems better. I mean, which one do you prefer? The first one? How many people prefer the 5 minutes, set up a laptop, 5 minutes, set up the laptop? Anybody like that? See, that's what I love about the Congress, is that there's always one guy. It doesn't matter what it is, there's always one guy. How many people prefer the 5-minute quick break, 5-minute quick break style? Okay, so thank you for that. I think I'm into the 40s now. I have received 40 emails from people and been in 40 separate conversations for people saying how absolutely unfair and rigid and F words, which I can't use in Germany. It is of me to insist on that, but that's kind of why I do that. And how are we doing, Pedro?
Yeah, 1 minute.
Okay. that's my line. I also really appreciate Big Alex for providing this LightScribe. We had just got it set up last night, and I didn't actually realize that nobody in the audience could see it. So for tomorrow's round of lightning talks, which have the potential to be either incredibly awesome or incredible fail, in either case, it's going to be fun for you no matter how it is for me. But are you all good?
I'm okay.
Okay, all right. I'm done killing time for Pedro. So he will introduce himself. And let's huge round of applause for the session. And after this, we got to get out for the talk at 3:30. Thank you.
So I'm Pedro Noel. I'm from Brazil. Originally, I'm a philosopher. And I've been for the past 2 years, more or less, working as an investigative journalist, mainly focused on whistleblowing. Whistleblowers, and most of all in materials leaked by whistleblowers. I'm here today to present the first release of the Associated Whistleblowing Press through its Icelandic platform, which is called Yoast. So before telling you a bit what is the Associated Whistleblowing Press and Yoast, I'd like to say that it's an honor to be here and to make our first announcement exactly here and now. So thank you very much for your presence. So the Associated Whistleblowing Press, it's a non-profit organization now based in Belgium, which is dedicated to fight against corruption, malpractices, abuse, and struggle against also the violations of human rights. We want to provide like an alternative model for whistleblowing organizations, which means a decentralized model. So what we do is to build local whistleblowing platforms, working with local working groups, like grassroots working groups. So what we do, we help people in different cultural contexts to set up whistleblowing initiatives in general. Now we have Yoast, which is our first platform, and the only one until now. We plan to launch more in the field, in the next months or weeks. And Yoast is our first platform dedicated to Iceland. So we got to unite some journalists, activists, politicians in Iceland, which, like in this case, is Jón Bjarki, which is very controversial journalist, also dedicated deep investigations. He got fined by the Icelandic government for not leaking but mentioning old files. in a trial case. We got Birgitta Jonsdottir, who is also like a politician for the Pirate Party and like an activist. And we got Gudmundur Ragnar, which is an Icelandic like internet pioneer. And and in the case me and Santiago Carrion, which is like an Ecuadorian also investigative journalist. Today we present our first release, which were files received through Yoast. The data set that we present provides evidence that a handful of individuals and companies with strong connections to the Glitnir Central shareholders borrowed large amounts of cash from the bank with insufficient underlying collateral. It also provides detailed insight into the business dealings of many influential individuals that were at the forefront of the Icelandic business and political sector prior to the national financial collapse. Further included invoices and staff mail exchanges and also internet screenshots that Glitnir, a public listed company in the OMX Icelandic Stock Exchange, paid large sums towards the private expenses of then CEO Bjarni Armansson as he resided in an Oslo apartment prior to the crisis. So what is the Glitnir Bank? So Glitnir was a public listed financial company in the OMX, Icelandic Stock Exchange, made up by the state-directed merger of the country three private banks, the third largest bank in Iceland, with open operations in many European countries before becoming an early causality of the Icelandic financial meltdown in 2008. In 2012, Laurus Welding, the former chief executive of Glitnir, was sentenced to 9 months in prison for fraud, although 6 months were suspended for 2 years. Gudmundur Hjaltason, Glitnir's former head of corporate finance, was also found guilty in the case. So I will show you a bit of what we are publishing. About, I hope the internet will. So the first file, the first set is invoices, internet screens, and staff mail exchanges showing Glitnir paying former CEO Bjarni Armansson's expenses in Oslo. The release name, I don't know if I mentioned it, it's like Glitnir Files, Records of 2008 Icelandic Economic Collapse. So attached to each file, each section of file, we have a description. In this case, yeah. Nothing that I did not say before. So here, for example, we have email exchanges showing negotiations between staff saying that they were up to pay for Mr. Armansson rent in Oslo. Part of it is still in Icelandic, but we plan to translate and publish it in English. Here we have like an intranet screenshot, like comproving the payments. As far as we know, like a private company cannot pay for the personal expenses of any of its workers, which would constitute a crime in the Icelandic private company law. Next file is Book 1000. It's evidence pointing out the Glitnir's sold and bought in its own shares, among other things. This document was mentioned in a newspaper in 2010, but was never made public. So, the bank sells, in this files we can prove that the bank sells the same as it buys. That's probably to create sales to make it look as if there is something being sold, bought. The names of most of these companies figure in the SIC report. The SIC report is the special investigative commission, which was the commission done after the meltdown to analyze the crisis. The laws are mentioned in the report. The files were reported but never published by DV, which is an Icelandic newspaper. So here we have a complete list of these stock exchange movements. The ones marked in pink are movements which they buy and sell the same amount, probably just to make waves in the market. Third file is Glitzner 2007 shareholders and an overview of the bank's own shares. As defined by the paragraph 55 of the Icelandic company law, the legal limit was 10%, although according to these files, Glitnir had 30%. Also, in line 37, I'll show you, like, it's Benedikt Sveinsson is the father of the present Minister of Finance. So here we had to redact the names because we got almost the 7,000 shareholders of the bank. So we just left the first 41, as we thought that these ones were really relevant to understand like the economic crisis, because they were the biggest like shareholders. The file is a bit big, it has around 300 pages. Wait. Yeah, around 300 pages actually. Yeah, the last one is Glitzner 2007-2008 loans list, featuring very low risk loans to enterprises owned by the staff of Glitzner. And 5 billion Icelandic kronas loan to the current Icelandic Minister of Finance. So this is a list of Glitzner loans grants, both in general but as well specified by employees. The employees also had also companies which turned out to be a strategy, since when the shares became worthless and these assets were whipped out, the loans still stood. When economic collapse arrived, companies which acquired loans went bankrupt and there were no more debt, whereas those who had personal loans were then hit by huge debt. Glitnir allowed their employees to put loans into companies. Values are in 1,000 Icelandic kronas. Line 11 of the document refers to Bjarni Benediktsson, which is the current Minister of Finance of Iceland. In the SIC report, like it's pointed out that he owned just 174 million, although according to these files, he got 5 billion Icelandic kronas loan. So this is the list. We had also to redact it a bit because we maintained the values, so we would not expose third parties and people not involved. And yeah, that's it. Maybe it does not make a lot of sense to you here, but so why are we publishing that? We are publishing that willing that like an Icelandic community, both authorities, activists, journalists, they can better understand about their own history. So although we don't provide and we were not even able to fully understand the content of these files, we put it public in order for it to be crowdsourced and people by themselves understand the records of their own history. So I would like to thank a lot, like the IMI, which is the Icelandic Modern Media Institute, for the support since 2012 of establishing this initiative in Iceland. The FSFI, which is the Icelandic Digital Freedom Society. Globalix, run by the Hermes Institute for Transparency and Digital Human Rights, who provided us like a great and strong support for the last 1 year and a half. Thanks not only for the support, but also for their initiative, which is quite important, to provide like an open source whistleblowing framework. I want to thank Noisy Square to provide us the chance to interact with other organizations and communities and build projects together. And most of all, to our volunteers who anonymously worked for the past months very hard, both like tech sysadmins, programmers, journalists, although they prefer to remain anonymous. And that's it. We still have donations. Our staff is starving. We lack funds to run servers. So whatever you can help in anything, there is a donation button. For inquiries, we will be in the Noisy Square, so if you want to make questions or make comments or learn more about, just show there in the Noisy Square and we'll be like glad to help you. So that's it. Thank you very much.